Well, I'm pumped up about this show tonight. Hank Wesselman, we're going to have an update on the latest discoveries in anthropology. And also, as you know, for many, many months, people call into the program, they want to talk about shamanism. The word shaman means the one who sees in the dark. Up next, Awakening to the Spirit World with Hank Wesselman on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, anthropologist and author Hank Wesselman has conducted research with an international group of scientists for much of the past 40 years, exploring Eastern Africa's Great Rift Valley, especially in Ethiopia, in search of answers to the mystery of human origins. He's currently one of the primary investigators and discoverers of recently revealed 4.5 million-year-old hominid fossil skeletons from Ethiopia, and he's one of the best. Hank, I can't believe it's been almost 6 years since you've been on.
How are you doing, George? Has it been a trip?
My gosh, I'm getting old, Hank.
Well, you know, we've all been busy. I've been doing research in Ethiopia and Europe and all over the place. And, you know, I've been writing books and doing workshops and, you know, just doing what I do. And I moved back to Hawaii in 2007. for those of your readers listeners who've read Spirit Walker, my original farmhouse here in Kona burned down in 2004. You know, the suspicion is that Pele, the volcano goddess, took it.
Yeah.
Well, she knew that with a new house in Hawaii, you know, we couldn't resist coming back here. And so when the house was rebuilt, that's exactly what we did. So now we're living on a small farm in Honaunau on Hawaii Island, growing food, an organic farm, sustainable farm, in addition to everything else. So I've never been busier.
What was the mood out there this past weekend, Hank, when they thought the tsunami from the Chilean earthquake was going to hit?
Well, you know, Jill got me up very early and said, you know, there's a tsunami coming. Now, these guys can be really destructive. We live at 1,200 feet, so that's not a problem for us. But, you know, you never can tell what's going to happen to the grid. You know, the grid could go down, the water could go off.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, we didn't have a connector hose for the cast iron propane burner. And so I went up to the store and met all sorts of friends there. And they were doing the same thing. They were picking up supplies, you know, making sure they had enough beer and champagne and stuff like that.
I was in Hawaii last year, landed at the Kona Airport. That's a neat little airport.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's just very open, and you walk in, walk out. It's I like it. And of course, there's security there, but you just don't see them all the time.
That's right. You know, well, Jill and I actually watched the 3-foot tidal surge on our flat screen, accompanied by Bloody Marys at 11 o'clock in the morning.
I know some of my friends out there did not wish any danger on anyone, but they were kind of let down that nothing really happened.
Well, it was a good thing.
Yeah.
It was a very good thing, you know.
Absolutely.
We live in the middle of the ocean. We're very vulnerable here.
Absolutely. Taiwan just got hit with a 6.4 just about an hour or so ago.
Really?
So it's all around. Anyways, Awakening to the Spirit World. This is fascinating work. I know you've been on before. We talked about the journey to the sacred garden, spirit medicine as well. Tell me a little bit about this work.
Well, Sandra Ingerman, who is a friend and colleague who I've known for almost 30 years, she had an idea to create a new book on shamanism. And so she invited me to co-author, and she also invited 4 other shamanic teachers and writers to contribute to the book. Tom Cowan, who's a Celtic shaman, Carol Proudfoot, who's of Native American ancestry, Jose Stevens, who's worked with the Huichols in Mexico and the Shipibo in South America, and Alberto Violdo, who's worked all over the place, and especially in South America. And so we've created something quite unique. What we've tried to do is we've tried to give this ancient meditative practice, because, you know, if allow me to say this, shamanism is actually a form of meditation,
mm-hmm.
Combined with a physical stimulus and a very strong intention. And what we've tried to do is give it an upgrade and bring this ancient practice more into alignment with who we are as modern people living in a modern world. And so it's something quite unique with chapters on dreaming and ceremony and ritual. And there are actually 3 chapters on death and dying, which makes it really quite unique. I mean, you know, we've talked about death and dying from the shamanic perspective, and we talked about working with community, working with children. And I have that essay at the end of the book, which, you know, I alerted Lisa that maybe you might like to read that, The Transformational Community, because something very interesting is going on in the Western world right now. Very quietly and under the radar of the media, a rather large subculture has taken form. And I think of them as the Transformational Community because they're the people who are bridging what was into what's coming into being. We're kind of like the seed people for the next cycle of ages. And all of the writers of this book, Awakening to the Spirit World, you know, we could be considered a circle of elders because, you know, all of us have been, you know, teaching and writing for a very long time. So we're all very accomplished in this practice and this way of life. And so in bringing our thoughts together about this community, one of the things that has come out is that there's a very interesting spiritual complex, a new spiritual complex, which is taking form in the center of this community. And this is very much in alignment with an indigenous prophecy.
Really? What was that?
Well, you remember, everyone has heard of Black Elk.
Yes.
The old book, Black Elk Speaks.
Yes.
Well, Black Elk was a Oglala shaman and medicine man who passed away, I think, in 1949, 1950. And before he actually passed, he dictated his second book to another anthropologist named Joseph Eppes Brown. That one isn't as well known. It's called The Sacred Pipe. And the subtitle is The Seven Great Rituals of the Oglala Sioux. And in the beginning of this book, he recounts the myth of White Buffalo Woman and how she gave the sacred prayer pipe to the people, the Lakota, in the mythic past. And after she'd given the pipe to the assembled gathering, she turned to leave, and then she stopped, and she turned around, and she said, "Remember, in me there are four ages. In every age I shall look in on you, and at the end I shall return." Now, the Sioux, the Lakota, believed that at the beginning of this cycle of four ages, a buffalo was placed in the west, and the buffalo's job is to hold back the waters. Now, that's a pretty interesting thing for people who live in the center of North America who've never seen the ocean to say, don't you?
Sure, absolutely. And Black Elk was quite a person. Did you know at the age of 12, he participated in the Battle of the Little Bighorn?
Yeah.
Custer. I mean, that's amazing. And you're right, he died in 1950. Yeah. That's when I was born, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. Well, you know, he was one of the last of the true traditionals, never learned how to speak English, ended up in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, went all the way to Paris.
Mm.
But, you know, he was also a very powerful shaman and medicine man by virtue of this great visionary experience he was given. I think he was 8 or 9 or 10 years old when he fell into a coma and was taken into the spirit world, and he was shown various things by the Council of Elder Spirits. Anyway, in this book, in recounting this myth, you know, The Sioux believe that in every age the buffalo loses one leg, and every year it loses one hair. And when all four legs are gone and the buffalo is bald, the waters are going to rush in once again, and everything's going to be destroyed in a catastrophe. Now, you know, this is of more than just passing interest when you consider the rising sea levels and the threats of global warming and the big meltdown which are sort of facing us at this time. Especially since several white buffalo have been born over the last decade.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, and they never tend to live very long. This is very interesting. It's like they come in as messengers, and then whack, you know, something happens. They get struck by lightning, or they fall ill and they die, this sort of thing.
It's not like they're unhealthy.
No.
No.
No, it's they're coming in as messengers, and once the message is delivered, their job is
gone.
And their contract is up.
Yeah.
Well, on the other side of the world,
sounds a little biblical, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, on the other side of the world, it's the Hindus. Well, you have the Hindus. And for the Hindu, the bull is the symbol, the sacred cow, the sacred cattle. Now, the bull is the symbol of the Dharma, the teaching. And each one of the bull's four legs represents one of the four ages, one of the yugas. And both the Sioux and the Hindus are in agreement that both the buffalo and the bull are now standing on their last leg. But, you know, here comes the prophecy. Black Elk said something before he passed. He said, you know, with the ending of this cycle of ages, And this, of course, implies 2012 and what's coming up. With the ending of this cycle of ages, the primordial spirituality will reemerge and reestablish itself, and it will be on this foundation that the next cycle of ages will begin again.
And did he see this through his shamanic meditation?
Yeah, he did. Uh-huh. And for our purposes tonight, you know, the primordial spirituality is the shaman's path of direct revelation. And over the last 30, 40 years, it's become a major thrust of the modern mystical movement going on in Western society. And more people are now interested in the techniques and the traditions of the shaman's path. It's essentially a methodology, but, you know, when it's practiced with reverence, with humility, and with self-discipline, it can become a way of life that may utterly transform the one who practices it. And so a lot of people are interested in this, and that's what this book, Awakening to the Spirit World, is all about. It's really oriented towards those Western people, both beginners and accomplished practitioners, to give them a running start if you're a beginner, and a definite upgrade if you're an accomplished practitioner, an accomplished inner traveler. And so it was a great project to work on, and it was really great working with Sandy Ingerman.
Now, you are an anthropologist. You're a scientist. How did you get interested? How did you get involved into investigating shamanism?
Well, you know, this is a very interesting story, because when I started out at Berkeley doing my doctoral work there, you know, it was the late 60s, early 70s, and I was participating in research expeditions funded by the National Science Foundation. I was working for a big-name professor, and we're out there in southwestern Ethiopia surveying these immense fossil beds, which were just loaded with fossils. I mean, everywhere. Elephants, giraffes, carnivores, monkeys, baboons. I mean, you name it, we had it. And scattered amongst these fossils were the fossilized remains of early human beings. And what we were doing is we were looking for evidence relevant to the origin of the human family. You know, the golden fleece, in a way, of paleoanthropology has been to find the missing link, because Charles Darwin himself predicted that the missing link between humans and apes would eventually be found in Africa. And so everyone has been feverishly looking for this for the last 40, 50 years. You know, several big research expeditions all over the place in Kenya, Ethiopia, Tanzania, South Africa, even as far away as Chad in West Africa. And it was back there in 1971, 72, as a graduate student, I was in this tented safari camp. I'd be out there for a couple of months at a time, you know, 600 miles from the nearest cold beer or hot bath.
Sure, and it's a long time.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's one thing to go camping over Labor Day weekend. You know, it's something quite different to be out there for months at a time, and it goes up to 110, 115 in the daytime. And at night, you can walk around under the stars because, you know, the sky is undimmed by a single man-made watt of light. This was one of the places where humankind was born. And it was out there in the desert that I began to have these visionary experiences. Now, at that time, I was about 30 years old. And at that time, I really had no idea what these were. They were very vivid daydream-like experiences in the middle of the day when I was very much awake. And at night, I was having these classic out-of-the-body experiences where I would have this strange soaring sensation in my body, and I would find myself bumping up against something hard, and I would open my eyes and look, and I'd be up against the ridgepole of the tent, up on the ceiling of the tent, and I would look down, and there would be my body below me asleep on my sleeping bag. Now, you know, I wasn't prepared for this. I wasn't psychologically prepared for this when I was at that age. And in those days, you know, I can honestly say I worshipped solely at the altar of science. I'd always been interested in UFOs, but, you know, I'd never experienced anything like this. And so I was, you know, doing survey and archaeology and paleontology and geology during the day and, you know, paying attention to, you know, being a field scientist in the bush. Well, I began to have these experiences. And this is not the sort of thing that you discuss with your fellow colleagues.
No, they
if
don't
I could
like
put it
to
this
hear
way.
this, do they?
They're really not interested in talking about anomalous experiences. In fact, you become instantly suspect, as if you've been contaminated with New Age non-science or nonsense, as the case may be. But the African men who worked with me, I turned toward them, and I discovered that they held a worldview which was very, very different from my own. For starters, they believe that the dream world is the real world, and this world that we take so much for granted is a projection of the dream world, not vice versa. They also understand that all of us are dreaming 24 hours a day. You know, you're dreaming right now in Southern California, I presume, and I'm dreaming right now in Hawaii. But because I've got the lights on and I'm talking on the telephone to you, you know, my focus is with you and the conversation that we're having, and by extrapolation with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are listening in as well. So I'm not perceiving my dreaming right now, but it's going on, whether or not I'm perceiving it. I mean, this was a very interesting worldview. And this was also accompanied by the conviction, very, very strongly held, that everything dreams. Rocks dream, rivers dream, animals and plants dream, mountains dream, stars and suns dream, the universe dreams. And it's through this process of dreaming that the reality that we take so much for granted came into being.
And I believe all shamans believe this too, don't they?
Well, I was just going to lead up to this. One of the men who was working with me was an indigenous man from that region. The tribe that he belonged to, they called themselves the Dasnich. They lived along the Omo River. And as some of our listeners are aware, the Omo River houses some cultures which have virtually never seen outside people before. This is one of the remotest regions of the world. And so here I have this Dasnich tribesman working with me, and he was a shaman. So there was this one day I remember I was out excavating a fossilized hippopotamus and giraffe combination. It was kind of a channel leg where the river, the ancient Paleo River, had created this meander bend and dumped a lot of bones in the gravels of the meander bend. And then these bones had become fossilized over time, and they were eroding out. So I was working on this excavation, and I'd been having this very strange experience over the past 2 or 3 weeks, this creepy crawly feeling that something was watching me.
That's always a weird feeling, Hank,
isn't it? It's a weird feeling. And, you know, it's considerably easier to feel than it is to explain.
Yes.
And so, listen, out in Africa, we had buffalo, we had lions, we had hyenas, we had leopards. So when you get this feeling like you're being watched by something, there's always this concern that you could end up being the dessert for some large carnivore. Well, on one particular day, it was about, God, it must have been noon, and it must have been well over 100 degrees, 110 degrees. And I was preparing to go back to the camp to have some lunch with my crew. And I remember standing up and sort of brushing the dust off my arms, and this feeling suddenly surged that I was being watched by something.
When we come back, Hank, after the break, tell us what you think was watching you. A little bit later on in the program, we're going to play a drum portion of a CD that Hank provides with his work, Awakening to the Spirit World, which will kind of help you on your own shamanic journey. I've been listening to it all night. It's fascinating. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you have an iPhone, you can sign up for Streamlink and listen to the program on your iPhone these days. And Streamlink, of course, you can get archives and podcasting and just have some darn right fun. Just go to coasttocoastam.com and search for Streamlink. Thank you. If you want to pick up your story where you felt eyes were watching you.
Well, on this occasion, I was working with this Dasnich tribal man. And as I've said, this guy was a shaman. And so I stood up, and I had this very strong feeling of being watched by something. And I kind of slid my eyes underneath the brim of my hat around to my right. I didn't see anything. But I slid them towards my left. And then just for a moment, with my peripheral vision, I saw something. It was big, and it had spots, and it was about 6 feet off the ground. And when I looked directly at it, it just disappeared. It was though something stepped through a rip in the fabric of the air and then zipped it closed, leaving this momentary wrinkle that straightened out and then was gone. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe it's time to go back to Nairobi and have a hamburger. But then I looked at this shaman, and this shaman was watching me. And suddenly I understood that he had seen it too. And he knew that I'd seen it. And I knew that he knew that I'd seen it. You know, it was one of those things. So I looked at him and I said, Atiko, that was his name. Atiko, kwa nini? What was that? I was using Swahili. And he gave me this long, measuring look. And then he pointed directly at where it had been. And he said a single word in Swahili, Shaitani. Shaitani is the Swahili word for spirit.
Interesting.
But unfortunately, my Swahili was really minimalist. And so we never really got very much beyond that in terms of explaining what it might have been. But, you know, once you've had the direct experience yourself, things tend to shift. They tend to change. And in fact, experiences like this began to change me. But, you know, I wasn't ready yet. This is back in the early 70s. And I resisted. I resisted going in that direction. And so I kind of closed up my field notebooks with my cryptic notes to myself and went on with my life. But then, you know, in Berkeley in the early 80s, I ended up in a workshop with the famous Michael Harner. And, yeah, I attended it largely because I was an anthropologist, and I thought, well, you know, I might have to say something about shamans and the New Age movement in a lecture someday to my students. So I ended up taking this workshop with some misgivings, and I ended up being paired with this young woman named Sandra Ingerman, all right? And she was at that time a student over at the CIIS in San Francisco, where she was getting her degree in counseling psychology. I was finishing up my PhD in anthropology, and we did a shamanic exercise in this workshop. And at that time, you know, I didn't believe any of this stuff. You know, I was just vaguely interested. And the exercise involved working as a team in a pair, where one member of the team would go into the spirit world, into the world of things hidden, and find a helping spirit to come and be in relationship, in this case, with me. So here I am lying on the floor of this gymnasium in the dark next to this beautiful woman, and Michael Harner's blamming away on his drum, and I'm lying there wondering what I'm doing there. And this woman goes into deep trance, and about, oh, maybe 10 minutes later, she leans over, cups her hands, and blows into my heart. And I felt this incredible surge of warmth, and it was as though something dimly remembered had come back to me. It's like your advertisement in psychometry, you know, it was very much like this. You know, something came, and I wasn't sure what it was. And then at the end of the exercise, we set up, and Sandy turned to me, and she said, well, you know, I was guided to a place where I had never been before, and I discovered this tall, spotted being that looked like a leopard. And as she was listening, as she was describing this being, all of my hackles started to stand up. Because what she was doing is she was describing my childhood imaginary friend who I used to have imaginary adventures with in Central Park in New York.
How could she do this?
That's a good question, George. You know, these are the kinds of experiences that impress the scientist, because there's no way she could have known about my childhood imaginary friend. In fact, you know, I was then in my early 30s, and I hadn't thought about this stuff in, you know, like 20 years, you know, since I was a kid. So, you know, this was a beginning. This was a beginning for me. So I took several workshops, and about a year later, I began to have these spontaneous visions that are described in my first book, Spirit Walker. And in the very first vision, I underwent what was called, what we could call a classic shamanic initiation. Now, I didn't know it was a shamanic initiation, but I was lying in bed next to my wife, who was pregnant with our first child. She was reading a book. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and she couldn't sleep because all her ligaments were loosening up in preparation for birth giving. And so I sat up and I tried to make things better by massaging her. But, you know, inevitably the magic that touch creates progressed into a joyous marital encounter. And we made love. And on the heels of this marital encounter, I was just absolutely blissed out. I was preparing to go back to sleep. And suddenly my physical body was invaded by these feelings of power or force, which have been could have been very disturbing if the feelings hadn't been, you know, quite so incredibly fabulous. The feeling was very much like, imagine yourself on a swing with very long ropes. Unless you have children, you probably haven't done it in a long time. But as you swing down and up in this heady arc on the swing, your body fills with this rush of sensation again and again
and again, and again
and again when you're swinging. This is what it was like. And in my case, this rush of sensation came in, and I suddenly discovered that my physical body was completely paralyzed and I couldn't move. I was absolutely as rigid as a stick. Well, I remember looking up at the ceiling and blinking, and then it's kind of like I blacked out, if I could put it this way. Everything went dark, and when my visuals came up again, I was standing in this dark forest. All around me, I could see these trees in the darkness. It was like black on black. And, you know, these sensations were just unbelievable. I was just soaring on these sensations while I'm looking at these trees. And suddenly I heard Jill turn the page of her book. So although my physical body was lying in bed next to her in this deeply entranced state, I could still sort of perceive in both worlds at the same time, if you get it.
You were in altered states, yet there was nothing that really contributed to getting you there other than meditation.
You know? Yeah. There was, because the three great gateways into transcendent experience are meditation, and the shamanic method is a form of meditation, tantra, i.e. lovemaking, and trauma. Many people who've had a terribly traumatic experience have been precipitated into visionary states of consciousness, and they emerge with these incredible stories. So here I was in this visionary state of consciousness in the world of things hidden. Now, what I didn't know really clearly at that time, which I know now, and of course, Sandy and I, in writing this book, have gone to great pains to try to explain exactly what these experiences are, where they're happening, where they're coming from. You know, I mean, she's very highly educated in psychology. I'm an anthropologist. Everybody else in the group is highly educated as well, psychologists, historians, anthropologists. So this isn't kind of like a softcore book. It's more like a hardcore book. And so here I am in what the shaman would call the world of things hidden. Shamans tend to perceive the world as made up of two distinct halves. There's a world of things seen and a world of things hidden, and they draw no distinction between them. The shaman understands that they present themselves together, mixed into one common reality. But the shaman is a gifted individual who discovers, usually early in life, that they have the ability to trance very easily. And in this expanded state, in this altered state, if you will, they are able to perceive, they're able to go into the world of things hidden. And one of the first things they discover is that this world is inhabited. It's inhabited by those transpersonal forces that the traditional people call spirits. We might call them transformative forces or transpersonal forces.
What do we call them? What do we call them? Ghosts?
Ghosts, the spirits of the dead, are found there. This is where the gods live. This is where the spirits live. This is where the ancestors live. And the shaman is a gifted individual who, through coming into relationship with these transpersonal forces, is able to do various things, initially on behalf of themselves, and then increasingly on behalf of other people. So here I was, lying in bed in Berkeley, next to my wife, precipitated into a shamanic state of consciousness. And of course, I had really no idea what was happening to me. And there under those trees, I perceived this huge, dark, monolithic form. It looked like a shadow that was standing upright. I could see a head, a small head, shoulders, and then it went all the way down to the ground. And it was easily, you know, 15, 20 feet tall. It was huge. And you know, I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, I'm wondering if these sensations that are happening to me in my body are coming from this being. And at that moment, the forces start going up, like somebody's turning up a rheostat. And I found myself gripped in this invisible fist, which was wrapped around me. and I was very gently lifted off the ground. Now, my heart is just hammering away. You know, I'm really, really excited. I'm not exactly terrified, but I'm not exactly at ease either. I mean, I don't know what's going on.
And you're awake.
And I'm awake. I'm wide awake. And my wife, I can hear the page of her book turn again. So I'm picked up, and at that moment, my heart stopped.
What do you mean your heart stopped?
It stopped. I mean, it was going off like a drum in my head. I could hear it going, kabum, kabum.
You mean like kabum, heart kabum, attack kabum. Stop?
It stopped. I couldn't hear it anymore. And I suddenly realized that I was dead. And I looked up at this being that was gently twirling me in space. I'm about 15 feet off the ground. And there was this emanation that came from it. And the feeling that it accompanied it was, here, let me show you something. Now, what are you going to do about it?
You're lying in bed next to your wife.
That's right.
And you die.
What happens next is that I go into this state of intense curiosity and awe. Now, I'm pointing this out because I think if I had gone into terror, if I had gone into fear, I wouldn't have passed the test. I don't know what would have happened to me, but I wouldn't have passed the test. But I think when I went into that state of awe and curiosity, I passed some kind of test. And then I was very gently put back down on the ground again, and my heart started again.
They literally jump-started you back to life.
I was jump-started back to life, and the whole vision began to fade, and the bedroom in Berkeley began to come back in again. Now, I sat up in bed. I mean, I was just wild. Tears were streaming down my face. My muscles were shuddering with shock from this incredible pressure that had held me. And I turned to look at Jill, and she was asleep.
She had no idea what was going on here.
She was asleep, but she'd been awake throughout.
Yeah.
And she was aware that something was going on.
So some time went by on this.
I don't know. I mean, I'd gone into the timeless. The shamans say that the world of things hidden is the world of the timeless. We're the people of time. We live in time, which is the visible physical world. The spirit world is the timeless world. And I'd been taken in, and I'd been shown the existence of this power, which was beyond my wildest imaginings.
Did you ever go into the hospital afterwards or anything like that?
Well, you know, I had another experience about a week later. And then about 6 months later, I had a real beauty just to make sure I was paying attention. Now, I'm telling you this because you asked me how I, a scientist, got into this stuff. You know, this is about direct revelation. I was having these direct revelations of something which I did not learn about in graduate school at Berkeley.
No, I don't think so.
You know, I'd gone beyond science. I'd gone into meta-science. I like to call it meta-science. But, you know, this experience and the ones that followed stopped at that point, and I began to read. I began to read about shamans and find out about the shaman's world and what shamans are able to do. And I sensed that I was, in some way, shamanizing. And I didn't even know I could do it.
Were you obsessing on it?
I was obsessing on it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it became the only show in town for a while. But it wouldn't start up again, and nothing I could do seemed to be able to jumpstart it.
And you tried to do it on your downtime, I guess.
I tried to,
yeah.
But I couldn't get back into that same state of ecstatic, power-filled, force-filled, whatever it was. Now, I believe that I had a direct transformative experience with death. And this is why shamanic initiation is often, you know, called the most astringent and difficult of all the spiritual initiations, because all of the other initiations in Buddhism and yoga and in transcendental meditation and in Sufi, I mean, they're like a walk on the beach compared to shamanic initiation, because inevitably the shaman to be is brought into direct connection with the spirit of death. See, if I've got this right, and I believe I do, that great big black, you know, shadow-like being. Did you ever see the film Meet Joe Black?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was Joe Black, and he didn't look like Brad Pitt.
No.
I believe I had a direct connection with the Angel of Death. And the Angel of Death came to see if I was ready. This is my interpretation, but, you know, it took me years to figure this out, because I didn't have any wise, honored, indigenous elder to turn to. for advice on any of this stuff. So I just had to tough it out on my own. But I don't know if you ever read my first book, Spirit Walker, but that's the story of how this all started up in Hawaii. And I began to have these visionary experiences in which my mind was brought into connection with the mind of another man.
That came out in 95, right?
That came out in 95. I don't think if I hadn't had a PhD after my name, I never could have gotten that book published. That's a book about time traveling. Because I found myself merged in some impossible way with the body and soul of a man who lives in the future.
You made many predictions about climate change, civilizations collapsing. It was almost as if you took a journey into the future.
Well, you know, people sometimes ask me, how has it turned out? Because that book was published 15 years ago, and I did make certain predictions. And, you know, I got 100%. All of my predictions have happened, and just as fast as I said they would.
Tell me how you did this.
Well, you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. This man who lives in the future lives somewhere on the western coast of North America. My sense is that it's California. But the Central Valley of California is filled with water, like Puget Sound. And the land is covered with tropical forests, you know, with jaguars and iguanas and lianas and parrots and toucans and trees 200 feet high. And it's a tropical rainforest. And my sense is that the worst-case scenario of greenhouse warming has happened. I was able to discern from this man's thoughts and his emotions that he lives in a time which he calls 249 generations after the collapse of the Great Age. Now, if you measure out 249 generations, it comes out to roughly 4,900 years. This guy lives approximately 5,000 years after the collapse of Western civilization. And so I began, you know, at the beginning of these visions, and this is what the book Spirit Walker is all about, this guy is in the process of leaving his community and engaging on a long walk. This is a journey of geographic investigation into the interior of the lost continent of America. He's the descendant of people who came in double-hulled voyaging canoes from Polynesia. Does this sound far out enough for you, George? I mean, this is a scientist talking to you.
Well, on this program, nothing's far out, Hank. You know that.
Well, you can imagine what this was like for me. I mean, this guy was...
Oh, this one for you, it was dramatic.
Well, what would happen is I would have these experiences usually on the heels of making love with my wife. And I would find my body invaded by these feelings of force or power. And my conscious awareness would re-geography itself. I would find my conscious awareness re-geographied, and I would find myself merging with another man in another slice of time.
We're at the break. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.